Hola, Sue. This afternoon, as we round off this week, we also round off the little mini-cycle of the three meditations on the cultivation of compassion. Today, of course, we'll extend on into the deepest dimension of suffering, the aspiration to free ourselves from it. It's our basic vulnerability, our fundamental existential vulnerability to suffering altogether. And it could sound like, oh, this is where faith comes in, this is where it becomes a religion and all of that. It's not really true. The very notion of religion is alien to Buddhism. The word doesn't exist in Sanskrit. So this whole notion of secular Buddhism, it's kind of like, it's a phony. The whole thing is phony. Because Buddha never taught a religion. The word doesn't exist. It's our Western construct. We invented it, we own it, and then we export it, superimpose it, and then say, you mustn't have it. It's really weird. It's like me looking over at Alma and saying, and then putting a wart on her, and just giving her a wart, and say, now we have to de-wart Alma. And that's wartless Alma. But wait a minute, you put the wart on. Yeah, well, never mind that. We want secular Buddhism. It's so interesting, and I think it's troubling for some people, perplexing for others, and enormously inspiring for yet others, that when the Buddha first turned the wheel of Dharma, he walked as a beggar from Bodh Gaya to Saranat. When he first turned the wheel of Dharma, when he first revealed the path, the first thing, I mean, wouldn't it be natural if the first thing he said was, hey, you guys, you know, his five compadres that he had been practicing with, you know, hey, you guys, I'm enlightened. I mean, I mean it. I'm really, you wouldn't believe it, but man, oh man, am I enlightened. I mean, that's what I would do, you know. You know. And he didn't. The first thing he spoke about is the satya, which means truth, but also means reality, the satya of dukkha, reality of suffering. One could say, you just achieved enlightenment and you came back and talked about suffering? Really? I mean, couldn't you talk about something more interesting than that? Like, what's it like to be omniscient? You know, something cool. But he directed coming back, you know, hot off the seat of enlightenment, where he directs these five students, these five companions, really, who now immediately become his disciples and ever so swiftly achieve arhatship, is where he directs their attention is not to him. It'd be so easy, but it wasn't. He directs their attention back to themselves and to the reality of suffering. If this is the reality of suffering, recognize it. But we don't need to secularize that. What's to secularize? You know, he's taking us right back to our experience. But why would he say something so ordinary? I mean, cockroaches and cobras and birds and all sentient beings understand suffering. We don't like it. But the whole point was, here's the reality of suffering. Recognize it rather than what you have absolutely habituating yourself to doing thus far. Doing your absolute best to avoid it. That's what we're utterly habituated to. Avoid it. We see any danger, any likelihood of suffering coming, and we're just going around the corner and we're weaving this way. We're like acrobats trying to, you know, do anything we can just to ward it off. Not me. I just want a little nirvana cocoon to sail through samsara. But I don't want to be touched. And so today, as we venture into compassion, let's not just go all esoteric suddenly, but let this be the encompassing one. And that is, suffering is not just on this deepest existential level. It's what my little grandson, when he falls down and scrapes his knee, that's dukkha. That's dukkha. That's suffering. He doesn't like it. It's painful. And so if we consider very briefly as we scan through, but it's the whole bandwidth. We're seeing the whole bandwidth. What are we up against here? What are we vulnerable to? At the very least in this lifetime, and man, oh man, if it doesn't stop, if suffering doesn't get terminated, if if it's not that easy, then let's do a full diagnosis. Because if this isn't going to stop, wow. So the suffering of suffering. And let's relate this immediately to the second noble truth, which so could be so easily, that the reality of the source of suffering could be easily, be so easy, and many people nowadays do tell us this, that the source of your suffering is something that is fundamentally beyond your control. That's the major message. That's the message of modernity. It's original sin, tough luck. Adam got to you, he did it first. And you're his progeny, so tough luck, but you know, original sin, you're stuck, you're screwed. And, you know, write a letter to Adam if you don't like it. But, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. It's history. So there we go for religion, and that's all of Abrahamic religions. It's out of your control. Then we have biology, thanks a million. It's, you know, it's natural selection, it's genetics, it's massive, it's millions and millions of years of adaptation and adaptation, so that everything we have, our craving, our delusion, our arrogance, our ego grasping and all of that, are absolutely hardwired. Why? Because they were, how do you say, adaptive. They helped us survive and procreate. So you'd have to stop being a human being. You'd have to just jump out of the whole evolutionary cycle to get out of the causes of suffering, because you're absolutely hardwired for it. Craving, hostility, ego, jealousy, the whole bit, it's all adaptive. So in other words, we're screwed. All it's good for is getting us some hedonic pleasure, but eudaimonic, forget it. That word doesn't mean anything in biology. The word eudaimonia means nothing. It does not translate into biologies. It's survival and procreation. It's trying to have some fun. But eudaimonia is not a biological term. It doesn't translate. And then we have psychology. Well, we know that. You know what's going on there. Then there's not even a whisper that we might be free. There is a deafening roar that our neuroses, our anger, our desires, our craving, our ego are absolutely built in. It defines us as being human being. These are simply human factors. And being unhappy is just human. And so just get over it, because as long as you're human, you got a consciousness, a subconsciousness. You got all these drives, a lot of them bestial. And just try to manage. Pretty much. That's it. And where's, you know, any other flavor that we have in terms of modernity? I think that pretty well sums it up. Religion, biology, psychology, any other voices out there? So if we look at the Buddhist diagnosis, all of these suggest that the causes of suffering are out of control. Oh, and I'll be on the other one, of course. Oh, by the way, you're screwed because you had a childhood. You know, your parents, it's probably, it's basically your parents. So, there you go. What are you going to do? So there it is. It's all hopeless. Because it's all out of your control. It's in the past. It's in your genes. It's in natural selection. It's in original sin. But somebody else done it, and we are just pawns floating down towards death and hoping against hope that it will indeed be termination. Because if it's not, oh, it looks really awful. And so the Buddha himself suggests, well, look at it phenomenologically. There's blatant suffering. If we really focus on the mental, because the physical is very largely biological, no question about that, the nervous system and all of that. But we look at the mental. Look at the mental and the tendencies to which we are prone. And now we're dipping into the second noble truth. Second noble truth being the fundamental cause of suffering is the mental afflictions, klesha. Karma is a problem only because of klesha. If it were possible with a magic wand or the Vajrasattva or anything else, just to absolutely clean the slate. I mean, super, hyper, steroid-empowered Vajrasattva. To totally purify every negative imprint you've ever accumulated in all previous lives. Imagine that. So it's now 4:43. Imagine you're ready? Ready to be pure? Okay, 4:43 and 20 seconds. Imagine right there with my magic thumb. You're totally pure of all negative karma. Well, by 4:43 and 31, you've probably had some really sarcastic thoughts. Direct you towards me, which is definitely negative karma. Now I have to snap my fingers again to purify you for the last 15 seconds. I'm just going to have to be clicking and clicking and clicking because your mental afflictions keep on, you know, even if I can purify you, your mental afflictions just keep on throwing more garbage in. So karma is not really the fundamental problem. Whereas if someone could just go like that and obliterate without trace all of your mental afflictions and their roots, you might indeed have a little bit of carryover, a little bit of baggage just to burn off of last karma. Past karma, like Moggallanaputra, but you're finished. That is, there won't be any more. You will not accumulate any more negative karma because your mind is totally free of mental afflictions. So between karma, between mental afflictions, klesha, and karma, there's no question about it. One is primary and one is secondary. Knock out all the karma, but not the klesha, you're still screwed. Knock out all the klesha, but not the karma, well, you might have some baggage, but it'll be gone soon. And so really, you're pretty well set. So if we just look right at the klesha themselves, and we just go, let's keep it simple. Let's focus on the three primary toxins. Let's call it hatred, and then craving and attachment, and then the delusion of I am. It's pretty obvious, I think, to most people. It's really obvious to me, and I don't think I'm especially bright here. I think it's just normal, is that this whole bandwidth of anger, hostility, hatred, aggression, It just hurts. It just hurts. The whole bandwidth of it. It feels awful, doesn't it? I mean, I guess I've heard that some people really enjoy it. I've heard some people, but I never have. I don't even know how, I can't even imagine enjoying being hostile or resentful or vengeful or hateful. I can't even imagine enjoying it because I know what enjoyment's like and it's just not like that at all, you know? And so if we consider this, that here is a mental affliction, and we don't have to have faith here. We have to just open our eyes. Here's the reality of suffering. Here, is this or is this not a cause of suffering? Does it or does it not disturb the equilibrium, the peace, the serenity, the poise, the sanity, the composure of our minds? Yes or no? It's not an issue of faith. It's an issue of being perceptive. And I think if we are just paying attention, it becomes obvious that insofar as our minds are prone to that bandwidth, it's miserable. And if it becomes a habit, this is a psychological truth. I mean, it's been known for a long time, but psychologists have gained some fresh insight into this. People who are just repeatedly angry about something, the weather or traffic jams or the news or politicians, but they just, no matter what, they find something to be pissed off at. Depression is just going to be following them around like a shadow. So this is what really staggered my imagination. I was just blown away when I heard the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health tell about all of the drugs they had to manage depression. And the Dalai Lama said, yeah, but doesn't depression come from many different causes? And wouldn't you want to treat it differently depending on what causes? And the director of the National Institute of Mental Health said it doesn't matter what the cause are. The drugs work. And I thought, my goodness. Was this brain damage? Is it psychosis? What is it that could give rise to such an answer? By a man who's the director of the National Institute of Mental Health. That, I must say, it boggled my mind. How can anybody be that? I'm at a loss for words. But the Dalai Lama has this incredible buoyancy. So, cause of suffering. If we can imagine facing adversity, facing just whatever comes up in life, politics, economics, ill health, other people's misbehavior, our own misbehavior, and so forth. If we can imagine venturing out into life, engaging with the world, and just with the ongoing flow of recognition, whatever the situation is, anger, hatred, aggression, malice, not the answer. They're part of the problem, not part of the solution. And to envision, could it be possible? Could it be possible to do whatever needs to be done? If this is not apathy, this is not just complacency or anything like that. It's it's about as vigorous as the Dalai Lama. Here he is, a globetrotter, traveling all over the world at the age of 75. He should have retired 10 years ago, enjoying Dalai Lama heaven, you know, just enjoying meditating, sitting quietly, and letting, you know, somebody else do the work. Here he is at 75, tremendous dynamo of energy, such goodwill. And, boy, who is more aware of the conduct of other people? And yet such buoyancy, such lightness, joy, and so forth. So if we're looking for some one, not the only one, but some really obvious, powerful cause of blatant suffering, we don't need to look further than anger, hatred. So much of the unnecessary suffering in the world is coming from that. There was one more bombing in Iraq, and now they didn't even give a number. They didn't even give a number. It was in the headlines a day or two ago. Just one more bombing in Iraq. It's kind of like one more bird flew by. One more cloud just came over, you know, obscured the sun. Another bombing in Iraq. A lot of people died. Now they don't even bother with numbers. Just a lot of people died. Why? But a bombing, what? Was it an accident? No, somebody's pissed off. And that would be something helpful. To blow up people. Their own people. It wasn't blowing up Americans. That I understand. But blowing up fellow Iraqis who are all Muslim? Frankly, I don't get it. I don't get that one at all. So looking for the cause of the suffering and then imagining as we go into compassion, imagining ourselves and religious people and non-religious people and young and old and rich and poor, imagine them being free, imagining us be free of anger. What a world. What a world that would be. Imagine. We go to the deeper level of this craving, the grasping, the clinging, the greed, and so forth. Driven. Hoping that objective reality will deliver what it was never designed to deliver, can never deliver, will never deliver, and still clinging, grasping, hoping, give me satisfaction. Never happened, never has happened. More suffering, suffering of change. It's not a matter of belief or faith. It's keep your eyes open and just look. Is it true or not? It's grasping and clinging onto hedonic pleasures that we don't have, wishing for them, that we get them, that we hold on tightly, so thinking somehow they'll be immutable and I'll be immutable and this will work out really well in the long term. It's psychotic. It's delusional. So a deeper level of suffering. Much more pervasive. Could we touch the world lightly? Touch the world lightly. Acquire, as the Buddha suggested, with such just extraordinarily simple sanity. Could we all, 7 billion of us human beings, who are the big mischief makers on the planet, no other species is doing the mischief that we are. Could we, 7 billion human beings, could we touch the world lightly? That in terms of material acquisition, we just take what we need. And in terms of pleasures, enjoy. Without squeezing the planet dry like we have another one spare. We live taking care of future generations by not driving ourselves and future generations into debt. Living reasonably and not expecting more from objective reality than it can ever deliver. Can we imagine living, enjoying life, whether as renunciates, as yogis, as monks or nuns, or as family people, but touching the world lightly? And therefore avoiding never having happen this massive dimension of suffering that comes from craving and grasping, clinging and attachment. Can we imagine that? And then we go to this deepest dimension that is, you know, the one specifically for today, but embracing all. And that is why? Why? What is it? What's the root here? Is there anything deeper than this craving, which is grasping? Is anything deeper? The Buddha diagnosed it very, very briefly. But again, this isn't a matter of faith. We don't have to believe something. We just have to pay really close attention. The conceit of I am. This reification, this grasping of I, me, and mine. I, me, and mine. And as soon as that's there, these closely held skandhas, that's the direct translation, these closely held skandhas, my body, Does it look good? Is it? Am I okay? How do I look? Right? Am I not okay? Am I still good? Tell me, where's a mirror? Quickly, tell me how I am. Where's a mirror? Am I okay? You know, the body, the feelings, mental states, states of consciousness. But of course, unfortunately, it doesn't end with the skin. I was thinking of what it would be like to have a $300,000 sports car, like one I traveled in once. And I imagine having a car. I mean, I had a new car once. I think I probably told you a story, but I won't go that time. It was a new Honda Civic hatchback. But like one day after I bought it, you remember the story? Anybody hear it? One day after I bought, this was my first car I'd ever bought. I was 37, because I'd been a monk for all those intervening years. So my dad gave me when I was a kid, but here's my first car. And a cute little car, a little Honda little hatchback. It's made of aluminum foil. Or at least seems like it. Really light, really peppy. And it was brand new, I mean sparkling, and it was out in the sun. I lived out in Lone Pine at the time. And it was my sparkling new car, and I went into the one grocery market in Lone Pine. There's only one, doing some shopping. And I came out to my new car. I'd never had a possession this expensive before. And so it was just so perfect. And I put even on the license plate 21 Taras. Right? So this was a sacred car. It was not only mine, but it was blessed, you know. 21 Taras. And I came out to my car, and there was a woman, big ugly pickup truck next to my car. My cute little car, but this is a big ugly cowboy pickup truck. And it looked mean. And she opened the pickup truck door, and she just threw the door open. Just went, and wham, right into the side of my car, and put a big dent in my brand new car. She just threw the door open. She didn't care about that stupid little Japanese car. She had a Ford. You know what Ford people are like. And she dented my brand new car. It was like getting a concussion, you know? And then she just hopped in her truck and zoomed off. There was Pearl Harbor. There was the assassination of JFK. There were a number of major events in history that would just say, this was a day of infamy. That day was a day of infamy. And boy, I wasn't a monk anymore. And I wasn't going to take that. You don't put a dent in me and drive away as if who gives a hooey. This woman took off, and I took off after her. No way she's getting away with this. You just gave me a concussion, and you are not getting away with this. And I zipped out of there so quickly. She took off, and I took off after her. I chased her down, and she zipped down the road. She's heading south on 395, and I'm on her like a hound dog. And then she pulls off the main road, takes a left. She pulls into a big garage, an auto repair shop. Her husband owns it. So I just pull in right behind her and I say, you see what you did to my car? And I think she'd done it before because her husband said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. But what the moral of that story was, let me fix the car. The moral of the story was, when that pickup truck door went into the side of my car, it hurt. It hurt, let alone having a $300,000 Porsche. If somebody even comes and puts their hand on it and leaves a grubby human fingerprint on my brand new $300,000 Porsche, well, I'm just going to feel like I need a bath. Okay. Why? The tentacles of grasping of mine. If it's somebody else's Porsche, who cares? I don't care. Fat cat, your car, who cares? Fat cat's car, but if it's my car, well, this is a major issue. Insult America, if you dare, you know. My country. Western Hemisphere, you Eastern Hemisphere people. Judy, Eastern Hemisphere people. Look out. It was Eastern Hemisphere. We're Western Hemisphere people. You know. Don't insult the Western Hemisphere people. Or how about Northern Hemisphere people? Southern, any people audacious enough to be Southern Hemisphere people. You know. So wherever there's the grasping, I am, that's mine. We set ourselves up. So on this point we'll end, I will end, because I've been doing the monologue here. This is where the working hypothesis comes in. It's not a leap of faith, but it is venturing in and see, all right, for example, with anger, since it's such a smack in the face, there's nothing subtle about it, and it hurts. We can start applying antidotes, whether it's compassion meditation, loving kindness, mindfulness of breathing, whatever it may be, and see, is this absolutely hardwired? Am I just kind of like a robot that's programmed that if you grimace at me, you go like this, then I feel bad and I get angry right back? Is there any give here, any malleability? Am I absolutely hardwired to respond like some pre-programmed robot? Or can I start changing my program and not suffer as much? Can I start to enjoy life more by having less craving, grasping, attachment? Can I start to wake up and suffer less just in day-to-day life because of less grasping? Is that malleable? Is that possible? This is an empirical question, not a faith or belief question. So we don't need to secularize Buddhism. Just practice real Buddhism, and you'll see the issue of religion is kind of like, you know, put it aside. It's not part of Buddhism, so don't add it on and then take it off. And then we go deeper. What underlies the hostility? What underlies the grasping? Is it indeed true, I, me, mine, the grasping on I, me, mine? And what might it be? Isn't that intrinsic? Isn't that absolutely necessary for survival? Isn't that hardwired? Isn't that really just who I am? I have to grasp onto myself, otherwise I wouldn't exist. I'd be annihilated. Is that the case or not? In terms of something we can tap into long before we achieve liberation, the closest analogy I know of is a lucid dream. Where we know what it's like to be non-lucid. We know how vulnerable we are, as in totally, in a non-lucid dream. We got everything wrong. If Maria appears in my dream, I can recognize that's Maria, except for it's not Maria. That's Maria. But if Maria appears in my dream, even I got that wrong. Right? I think, oh, there's Maria. It's not Maria. Maria's, you know, 100 yards away in her bedroom. She's not in my dream. So, sorry, but even got that wrong. You thought it was Maria. It's not Maria. It's just appearances. There is a woman over there, but she's not in my dream. So I got everything wrong. My parents, where I am, what's happening, who I am, I got everything 100% wrong. Didn't get anything right. If I become lucid, at least I got one thing right. But it's so fundamental that then a lot of other rights flow out of it. I'm dreaming. So that's an appearance of Maria, that's an appearance of Carlos, of Luis, and so forth. But in that recognition, there is immediately some freedom. Immediately there is less vulnerability to suffering, because you know you're dreaming. And the more thoroughly you fathom the dream, and this is an integral feature of lucid dreaming, not just to become lucid, but now having become lucid through experience, not through philosophizing, not just through thinking, not through simply having belief or faith in the Buddha or praying to the Buddha, but by experimenting, transforming and emanating, gymnastics within the dream, seeing to what extent is this dream malleable, your own presence in the dream, other people, places, things, events, and so forth, how malleable? Is there anything that is inherently existent, anything existing by its own nature, resistant to your imagination, the play of working with the dream and modifying it at will? And through experience, this is all absolutely empirical, finding out for yourself there is nothing in this dream that is locked in to its own nature. Not me as the persona in the dream, not anybody else in the dream, not any place in the dream, not any situation in the dream. It's all malleable. It's all fluid. It's all a free creation of the mind. And in that, with that growing crescendo of insight, of fathoming the very nature of the dream, there is a growing fearlessness and a growing sense of euphoria of bliss. Even if you're just staring at an empty desert, the bliss is not hedonic. The bliss in a lucid dream is not because something really nice is happening in the dream. You could be sitting in a cell in a radically marvelously lucid dream and just be blissed out in your empty cell, because the degree of vividness, of clarity, of insight into the nature of reality you're experiencing is so thorough, so deep, so clear, that this is eudaimonia within the dream. And part of that joy arising from your heart, from your own awareness, hand in hand, like two lovers walking hand in hand, is fearlessness. It's fearlessness. Within the context of the dream, you can't be hurt. There's just nothing that can hurt you. There's no grasping within the context of the dream, no reified grasping onto I am you or mine. There's no reified grasping onto you're really over there and I'm really over here. Dualistic grasping isn't there. You're lucid. You're not reifying any object out there. You know they're not out there. You've already played with so much. You've shaped them any which way you like, like a potter. So there must be some correspondence there. Genuine happiness, eudaimonia, and fearlessness. And that's in a dream, and a lot of people have had lucid dreams. So we're not talking about something years and years away of incredibly highly realized yogis from Tibet. So it's a powerful facsimile of what it might be like to be awake in the waking state and not asleep like we are. So one can only try to imagine the compassion of one who is truly awake for all those who are not. And it's marvelous, quixotic, strange, ironic balance between these great enlightened beings experiencing in what in Tibetan is called mizube nyingje, unbearable compassion. Unbearable compassion, just not able to bear the suffering of others. Not able to bear it like a wise mother or a wise father seeing their child becoming a drug addict. And the child is bright and healthy and young and the whole future before them, and seeing my kids becoming a heroin addict at the age of 17. How could you bear it when you know it's so unnecessary? How could you bear it? So on the one hand, you know, this unbearable compassion. On the other hand, then you read these spontaneous songs of people like Milarepa, quite a few of them in the Mahamudra tradition, Dzogchen tradition, where it's just, it borders on hilarity of ha-ha, just ha-ha, like that, you know. I mean, you just read it, so you have to, you know, fill in some of the ambience of it. But this kind of this joyousness, almost like hilarity, of what a joke, what a joke. So I think for themselves, an enlightened being is aware of his or her own situation, at the same time aware of the situation of others. From their own situation, this just laughter, this pealing laughter, you know, what a joke that I could be so deluded, what a joke, how hilarious. Ha ha, I've translated some verses, these spontaneous verses of realization where every verse starts with ha ha, you know, ha ha, amazing, you know. Or Emma ho, amazing, Emma, ay ay ay, incredible, amazing. At every verse, you know, every verse, like, okay. So final point, and that is a number of you. In your meditation, we've been here now 6.5 weeks or so, speak of an underlying tension. Underlying tension, aka recurrent pressure, aka a restlessness, an unease, an anxiety, a feeling that something's holding us back, something we can't break through, all of a piece. I know that more than one person resonated with at least one of those nouns. It's not a bad sign. It's a sign you're waking up to something that was already there, because I don't think I gave it to you. I don't think the food gave it to you. It's not the mind center. It's not Thailand. You brought it with you. But we are just amazing modernity in our tenacity to cover that over with anything. With anything. The underlying tension, the underlying anxiety, the underlying sense of dissatisfaction. We are, man, we are clever. So clever. Such an array of legal drugs and illegal drugs. iPods. A study was just done, and then just meaningless chatter to drown out the silence of our own existence. A study was just done about teenagers in America. Any guesses about how frequently a teenager sends a text message during the waking hours of the day? How many? Every 30 minutes, one text message by a teenager. What on earth do they have to say every 30 minutes to somebody? And of course, when they're not sending a text message, anything to cover it over. Text messaging. You wouldn't believe the size of the stool I just left in the toilet. You know, anything. Anything. Really, I've seen some of the text messages. It's like, oh, is this kind of a way you just download all of your OCDD to the world to let everybody know all the crap that runs through the stream of your mind? No wonder there's so much text messaging. OCDD has become now lunch for everybody. And so we cover it over with this. We cover it in the major in modernity. It's covered over with work. And then we have something to be proud of afterwards. I work 60, 70 hours a week. That's how I stifle the reality of suffering. Or the latest flat screen, or the latest iPod, the latest I, something. And we need the latest version. So anything but the first noble truth and to recognize it. But here we are with all the layers peeled off. You know, even I keep on referring to my iPhone, but I just want you to know it doesn't work. I mean, it lights up. You know, but this iPhone right now is basically good for a meditation timer because it's not connected to the world, just like I like it. You know? So it's really just iPhone. I speak to myself. Here the layers have been peeled away in these 6.5 weeks. And that which was already there becomes evident. The tension, pressure, anxiety, something tight, something resistant, something that is not, how do you say, soft, malleable, doesn't break apart easily. What's up with that? Not to feel there's something wrong with us, as if you're an aberration, you're a mutant, there's something wrong, you're probably meditating wrong. Not. Shamatha is about peeling away. It's not about covering over. There's lots of meditative practices that can cover over in very nice ways. Shamatha is not one of them, certainly not the ones we're doing. They don't cover over anything, right? And so it's peeling back the layers. Layers of anger, layers of craving, and then this level. And facing that tension, that pressure, that tightness, that anxiety, that blockage, something seems to hold us back. And it doesn't take too much of a stretch of imagination to see there may be some underlying fear here, that what I'm clinging to is now being imperiled. What I'm clinging to more than my iPod or my possessions or my friends, my out there, is me. Is me. That I am. That I really am. And when I'm releasing in mindfulness of breathing, when I'm not even identifying with thoughts and images, hopes and fears, my personal history and my future in settling the mind into a natural state, and an awareness, when I puncture right through these empty facades of I am, the issue can arise, well, yeah, what's to become of me? It's such an easy thing to say, but this is coming now from a depth. Yeah, but what about me? How do I fit in? What about me? And this is exactly what the Buddha was referring to, relevant to this deepest level of suffering. It is the urge to really be someone. The urge to become. Urge to become. As an individuated, separate, autonomous, I am. The urge exists. But this practice of shamatha, then leading so smoothly, seamlessly into the practice of vipassana, is never to destroy something that did exist. Nothing that did exist no longer exists in terms of an agent, an observer, a meditator, an I, a self. Nothing's destroyed. It's just peeling away layers of delusion and slipping into it gently, releasing and releasing, gently walking. It's like there's a bay not far from here, just over to the west. It's a bay. It's a long bay. And you can see that it's very shallow, so you could walk and walk and walk and walk out into that water, and it would only come up inch by inch by inch, because the sand is very, very gentle incline out to the ocean. So that's what I would invite you as we slowly approach the end of this retreat. There's no point in this meditation where you need to jump off the deep end and say, okay, I'll try annihilation. Okay, I'll just release myself into the abyss, you know? But keep on walking through the shallow end towards the deeper end with each out-breath, with each just quiet awareness of what arises in the mind, releasing grasping, and see that the water is fine and that the tension that is holding us back, the pressure, the grasping, the anxiety that is holding us back, is like a little child who's afraid of the monster in the closet. You know, the fear is real. But all you really need to do is just open the closet door and turn on the light. And then you'll see nothing that was there was destroyed. And the fear was not necessary. So let's practice and give ourselves a break. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. Releasing the clinging, the grasping, the identification with your body, with your breath, and with your mind. And let them settle of their own accord, at ease, still, and clear. And then as we venture into the full bandwidth of the meditative cultivation of compassion, attend first of all to your own situation and the reality of suffering. Recognize it. The range of suffering to which you are vulnerable. The identifiable causes of such suffering. That may actually be within your control, that may be dispelled. At least attenuated, which you can see through your own experience. With this perception, arouse the yearning. May I be free of suffering, and may I attenuate the causes of suffering, and may I be free of the causes of suffering. With every in-breath, arouse this yearning and imagine it to be so. Free of anger, free of attachment and craving, free of the delusion of reifying ourselves and others, the very distinction between subject and object. Imagine being free. And let your attention free, loosen it, and allow other individuals and communities to come to mind. And whomever you attend to, arouse this yearning. May you, like myself, be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Let's practice as before, and let's continue in silence. release all appearances and allow your awareness to rest without grasping, without identification, in its own natural freedom. Hola, so not many notes today. One long one, one fairly short one. So the first one is utterly practical. What do we need to eat and what not according to our constitution or Tibetan element? Where can we find such information? What to do with constant headaches? Yeah, they're very practical and they are really medical questions. And of course, I do have no expertise there. In either account, nothing even remotely like expertise. I have translated one marvelous set of lectures. It was something like 19 lectures by Yeshu Dundan about 10, 11 years ago that he gave in California. It's a book called Healing from the Source. It's really quite marvelous. I mean, he's drawing from, I don't know, at that time, maybe 50 years of experience, consummate scholar, probably at that time still the greatest living Tibetan doctor. And so I know he addresses these issues of different constitutions, earth, water, fire, air, and so forth. So that's one book, but that's already 11 years old. So I would probably just check out. I'd probably go onto one of, let's say, Amazon.com and just type in Tibetan medicine, and see, because there have to be a number of good books. I forget his last name, but there, somebody translated. I think it's called The Quintessential Tantras of Tibetan Medicine. If you say Tantra, Tibetan medicine, and Berry, there's only one book that will come up. Can't remember right now, but he translated the two of the root tantras of Tibetan medicine. Must have been 20 years ago by now. I'm sure they're still in print. I think they were published by Snow Lion. Did a nice translation. It's solid. I can't hear. Oh, healing from the source. Oh, Yeshe Dundan. Y-E-S-H-I. Yeshe, that's how he spells it. D-H-O-N-D-E-N, Yeshe Dundan. It's a lovely book, just a whole series of lectures he gave to healthcare professionals at a major hospital in San Francisco. So he had a very, very, very well-educated, very well-informed audience, but they didn't know much about Tibetan medicine, but they were Western. So it was quite high level, but really quite wonderful. Then there was a book that Jeffrey Hopkins primarily translated. I translated just maybe 5% of it. And that was done, 35 years ago or so. Jeffrey Hopkins, but again, the author is Yeshe Dundan. Jeffrey Hopkins translated. And I co-translated it. I translated for, I don't know, several days. Can't remember the title. But Yeshe Dundan, he has only two books still in print. There's another one also, but in any case, those two, that earlier one that Jeffrey did, and again, it was the issue during his lectures, but over a period of like 6 months or so. And Jeffrey did, of course, an impeccable. He always does a very meticulous job of translating. So I can't remember the title right now, but that's also very good, and I'm sure it's in print. And there must be a number of other good books as well. What to do with constant headaches? Just everything you can, you know, checking with Tibetan medicine, checking with Western medicine, exercise, diet, all of that. I'm no expert. I mean, it's a major issue these days, but I have no special wisdom. I don't get them. If I got them, then I would have. Right now, in this retreat. Well, that's what our weekly meetings are for, and I've addressed it so many times. Keep your attention out of your head. The infirmary is really good. Bring your awareness out of the head, down to the abdomen, down to the feet, down to the earth element. Breathe out, relax, relax, relax when you breathe out. Take spacious walks. All of the above. Yeah. And watch your diet. Okay. Olaso. So here's one. If I understand correctly, the achievement of shamatha refers exclusively to the arising of physical and mental pliancy, and not to any one state of meditation. That's not true, no. A pliancy arises in waves. It occurs and it occurs and occurs. There are many waves. It's not just one deal, grand finale. Tsongkhapa addresses this in the Lamrim, that you'll have multiple, almost like sneak previews, as the energies are shifting and the pranas are shifting and so forth. So you may have bliss arising, you may have a sense of buoyancy arising and so forth, and then it passes. It was a really nice nyam, and then you get another rush, and it's better, and then when you have this a breakthrough, that's really what it is, a breakthrough, when you actually achieve shamatha, then you have something that is much more robust. And so the major characteristics are indeed the physical and mental pliancy, and that's access to the first jhana. So when we speak in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, when you achieve shamatha, you are achieving a very specific meditative state called access to the first jhana. That's right. And when you achieve that, an unprecedented degree of robust mental and physical pliancy arises. So first the pressure on top of the head, right? And then it's mental pliancy, so it's top down, top from mind to body, mental pliancy, physical pliancy, that catalyzes physical bliss, and that catalyzes mental bliss, crescendo, fabulous, immobilizing, incapacitating, and then it tapers off, and now it's like you turn, I've never done this, but a brand new Lamborghini, I think it is, yeah? Imagine, you know, with 12 cylinders, imagine turning it on and hearing all of those perfectly tuned 12 cylinders all coming at it at once. I won't even try to make this sound because my voice just isn't that melodious. But imagine it, and you turn it on, and then it's just, ooh. And then, of course, you release the key, and then, okay? When it first comes up, that's when you almost bliss out, right? But then it tapers off, and then you can really drive, okay? So,
I think I didn't use that word correctly.
No, you didn't. That's why I had to use so many words, but I'll read on. So that when one speaks of achieving shamatha in the course of kirim or tekchut practice, it means only that pliancy arises in that context and not that this event is preceded by the substrate consciousness resting in perfect stillness in the substrate. Not true. No, interestingly enough, and this is directly from Dujom Lingpa. Yeah, quite interesting. Dujom Lingpa, in this text that I read last night, I edited my own translation, where it's now being typeset, it has been typeset. He speaks of this, of when you're doing this practice, at some point, bliss, kharasa de semidopa, bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality will arise. And then when you're totally free of any clinging or grasping to that, then the mind implodes and you break through. So you're getting, bear in mind, when you get pointing out instructions, right, you're getting the fragrance. I mean, most people, unless you're, again, some spectacular human being. But normally, you're getting a fragrance that is a genuine, authentic fragrance of Rigpa, right? And then you take that as your object. That's it, right? It's pointing out instructions, or it's getting from a text, or what have you. So there it is. But you're not becoming a vidya. You're not, in the first instance, becoming a vidyadhara and then achieving shamatha in that, right? It's like emptiness. You achieve shamatha in emptiness. Well, you're getting conceptually veiled emptiness and then achieving shamatha in that. But becoming an arya is considerably in the future. So how he describes it is, yeah, your mind does implode in the substrate, and then you break right through it. So there is the lamgi rikpa, there's the ji rikpa. This is, as my understanding is, as of today. There's the ji rikpa, which is the ground, primordial, well, ground, as in ground of being, ground, pristine awareness. And that's tapping into it. It's the moon veiled by clouds, but you are actually tapping into. You are like looking at the moon through three levels of clouds. Are you ascertaining rikpa when you get the pointing out instructions? The answer is, yeah, the moon's right there. You're pointing in the right direction. Okay, good for you. Okay, keep the laser of your attention in that to burn away, in this absence of grasping, the layers and layers. Now, during the course of the practice, during and in between sessions, then you'll experience what, and I just saw this last night, so this one's very clear, lamgirikpa, and that's the pristine awareness of the path. And how is that characterized? You are directly perceiving all appearances as effulgences of rikpa. So your mind's not imploding anywhere. You're perceiving rikpa, but you're seeing like the ocean and the waves. You're seeing the waves are nothing other than the ocean. You are perceiving phenomena as being like that, right? But when you come to the culmination of the path, of this path, then the appearances themselves dissolve into dhammata. And then this is the pristine awareness of the fruition. So this, since you gave me this to read, I have to read it. I'm not going to let you interrupt yourself. Otherwise, I'm confused as to how practice, such a practice as tekchu, which does not involve the substrate or substrate consciousness. How can it not? I mean, you're aware. You're not. See, you're exaggerating the practice of shamatha within in the context of Dzogchen. You're exaggerating it. You're suggesting. I mean, there's the implication here is that you're simply perceiving rikpa with rikpa. Well, that means you're a vijadara. You've already arrived. Whereas this is a veiled. It's just like settling the mind in its natural state. But it's much, much deeper. And that is, you gave the right answer. From what perspective are you seeking to view the mind when you're settling the mind is natural? You are seeking to view it from the perspective of the substrate consciousness. Are you viewing it from this? When you are, for 3 seconds in a row, you are observing the space of the mind and its contents without distraction, without grasping. Are you observing it from the perspective of the substrate consciousness? Yes or no? Yes, you are. Veiled. You're on stage two, stage one. But what other perspective? I mean, that is the relative ground from which you're observing everything you observe. So it's not going to be different. It's not going to be different if you haven't achieved shamatha yet and you're practicing in Dzogchen. It's not going to be different if you're practicing shamatha on emptiness. It's not going to be different if you're practicing shamatha by way of stage regeneration or shamatha by way of texture. It's not going to be different. You haven't achieved shamatha yet. You haven't become a vidyadhara yet. Therefore, you will be viewing it from substrate consciousness. Now, substrate consciousness. Now, let's have somebody else answer. But I won't finger you. I'll just let you put up your hand as I have my pistol ready. In the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, observing space of the mind and its contents, are you observing space of the mind and its contents from the perspective of rikpa? Where's a hand? Who wants to be amputated? No, I don't amputate. I just have fun. Yeah, what? Yes or no? Yes. Carissa, yeah. What else? You think you don't have a Buddha nature when you practice shamatha? Or that it went to sleep and, you know, died? No, you are viewing the space of your mind. On the first day, the first session of the first day, when you settle the mind as natural state and you're observing, you are viewing it from the perspective of Rigpa, heavily veiled. You are viewing it from the perspective of the substrate consciousness, heavily veiled. You are viewing your mind from the perspective of a 24-year-old woman named Carissa, not veiled. But so, this is why it's so important to recognize these deeper dimensions are not something else that you achieve one day. So in the very opening lines of this text, Extracting the Vital Essence, Advice for a Mountain Retreat by Dujum Rinpoche, he says, your mind itself, he says, here's the view, meditation, way of life. Okay, let's begin with the view. Your mind itself is a Dharmakaya. So it's not something else. Hola, so I have to read the rest of this. Now that Alan has totally refuted me, if this understanding is correct, which it obviously isn't, okay, can I finish? Can I stop? Oh, my day. Now that I've been totally humiliated, thank you for your help. No, not at all. It's a good question. Good question. And of course, I don't know what I'm talking about. But
can I follow up,
sure. But with microphone.
I guess the reason I'm confused is because this morning when you were talking about the same thing from the Dujum Rinpoche text, it did, like, on the one hand, when you speak about Rigpe Choksha...
Speak about what?
When you're speaking of Rigpe Choksha, like...
Rigpe Choksha. Yeah. Rigpa Choksha.
Okay, Rigpa Choksha. It's... I mean, you make a point of distinguishing very much that it's a very different thing than Shamatha practice as such. Like, it's a different level of... I mean, after...
Rigpa Choksha, open presence, is not the same as awareness of awareness. Yeah, it's different.
But also that, I mean, it's the practice of Tekcho, right? That's different. That's, you know, having broken through the substrate.
Yeah. That's, you know, frankly, I don't think we need to spend much time here. Really, because it is such a rare individual. Mm-hmm. It's such a rare individual that's going to have that be the most effective way to achieve shamatha. To skip the breath, skip the mind, skip awareness, skip emptiness, skip stage of generation. I'm beyond all that. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're Dingo Genzen Rinpoche, but for the rest of us, Jacob, you know, I don't think it's that relevant. Yeah. The chance, it's like 1,000-to-1 odds. If I should teach it, no, it's much worse than 1,000-to-1 odds. If I should be teaching 1,000 people and say, you know, you've got a whole variety here, but you might try open awareness as a method to achieve shamatha. Oh, it's much less than 1,000-to-1. It's much, much less. The chances are almost certain they're going to sit there and they're going to practice Marmot Dharma. And I actually just discovered, I was reading the second text, fantastic text, by Dujum Lingba. That's what I read last night to proofread it. But the whole issue of Marmot, because I translated, I helped somebody else translate it. This text 10 years ago, so I'd forgotten it. I mean, details of it. It's Dujum Lingba, you know, in this text that covers shamatha and vipassana, and then the texture in this text called Mud and Feathers. Mud and Feathers is the name of the text. It's really quite charming. It's incredibly profound. But he was the one that said that, you know, if you don't have the view, you'll be like a hibernating marmot. Like a hibernating marmot. You just... And that's what people want to do. That's what people want to do. Especially people with no real faith and no real renunciation, and they don't want to do the hard work of shamatha, and they certainly don't want the hard work of vipassana. What a pain in the neck, you know. And stage regeneration is so difficult, you know. Visualization, this, that, and stage of completion. Give me a break. Did you look at those exercises in the yogis of Tibet? And so, and the four thoughts that turn the mind—they're just depressing, you know. I don't want to do any of that. I just want to be a Dzogchen practitioner. The temptation is fantastic, just to skip all of the preceding. So that's why I never teach it. I never teach it. People will naturally think, I tried the other ones, they didn't work out very well. But the awareness, it's just open presence. are they going to people go with that? And then the worst thing is, you know, that if they start doing that and start experiencing some bliss, it could happen. I mean, it's kind of fun. Then they start these spontaneous effulgences coming out. You won't believe what I'm about to say. But you know that the word for bliss is, or gawa, is pritti. People, this is really, it's really awful when it happens. People practicing open presence, and suddenly this spontaneous bliss comes up, and they just start singing. Yeah, they start singing. I'm so pretty. I'm so pretty. I'm so pretty.
Nice one.
The person who owns that song is Robert De Niro. If anybody saw Analyze This, Robert De Niro owns that song now. It's hilarious. It's Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro. It wasn't a fantastically funny movie. And when Robert De Niro, the mafia thug, starts singing I'm So Pretty, I thought that makes my, that's the all the hedonic pleasure I need for a month. Oh, lasso. Any more practice-related questions? We have these two that have been very patiently sitting here. They're going to continue to patiently sit there. But they're not going away anywhere. And at 6 o'clock, why don't we just take a break and enjoy dinner? Okay? And remember, whenever you're feeling low, I'm so pretty. So pretty.